It's funny when people do things that are unexpected, isn't it, you know? Kind of, you're supposed to say things, you're supposed to do things. What is it about silence that is so off-putting, you know? To sit and do nothing and not be busy. And that was only 20 seconds. And already you can see people going, you look at them and their heads drop and we're looking for places to look or turn away. Today, I suppose I want to ponder a couple of questions, and most of the stuff that I ever sort of talk about comes out of the experience of my own life. Because, you know, I think in reality it's really the only thing I truly know. So, but in relation to the question I want to ask or ponder today, it's the battle that I struggle with in terms of healing versus holiness. Which comes first? It's a little bit, or it can be a little bit chicken and eggish. You know, did the chicken come first or did the egg come first? Do we get holy and then become healed? Or do we get healed and then become more holy? How does that actually work? You know? It's kind of funny because I've had that conversation with probably, I reckon, 6 to 8 different people over the last 2 or 3 months. And one thing has been a constant in all that. And that is that... Every person I've spoken to in relation to that has said, well, if the focus is on healing, it's about you. It's about what happens to you. It's about whether or not you are healed. It's not about God. And if the focus is on holiness, then the focus is on God, which seems to make sense. What is it in our mind? What does holiness, or what does healing, or what the blessings actually look like? What is it that we strive for? What is it that we seek? And I know that over the last couple of months there have been a number of different messages where the focus has been on Jacob, you know? And I like Jacob. I think he's a bit of a character. He certainly was pretty tenacious. But if you've got your Bibles and you want to read, well and good. If you don't, then I've got the passage I'm going to read out. But it comes from Genesis 32, from verses 22 onwards. Genesis 32, from 22 onwards. And I want to look at this in the context of what does healing or blessing look like. During the night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two servants. Why he'd want four is beyond me, but anyway. Took his two wives, his two servant wives, his 11 sons, and he crossed the Jabbok River. After taking them to the other side, he sent over all his possessions. This left Jacob all alone in the camp, and a man came and wrestled him until dawn began to break. When the man saw that he would not win the match, he touched Jacob's hip, and he wrenched it out of the socket. Then the man said, "Let me go, for dawn is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Now, he's just had his hip dislocated. Most of us would be screaming and angling, and he's not going to let go. I mean, he's a tenacious character. "What is your name?" the man asked. He replied, "Jacob." "Your name will no longer be Jacob," the man told him. "From now on, you will be called Israel, because you have fought with God and with men, and you have won." How would you like to write that on a resume? What was the last thing you did? "I fought with God and I won." "Please tell me your name," Jacob said. "Why do you want to know my name?" the man replied. And then he blessed him there. Jacob named the place Peniel, which means face of God. For he said, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been spared." The sun was rising as Jacob left Peniel, and he was limping because of the injury to his hip. "Even today, people of Israel do not eat the tendon near the hip socket because of what happened on that night when the man strained the tendon of Jacob's hip." Now, if you read some of the notes and some of the scholars in some of the study Bibles, it also goes on to say that that was a perpetual thing for Jacob. Jacob walked the rest of his life with a limp, depending on which scholars you read, as a perpetual reminder of God's blessing on his life. I don't know that I would see a dislocated hip as a sign of God's blessing on my life. I mean, how many of us would actually see that kind of pain as a blessing? What does blessing look like to us? What are we looking for when we look for blessing, when we look for God's favour in our life? What does healing actually look like? And what is it about pain that's so unbearable? Pain, or the perception of pain, does strange things to people. It changes our focus from what's important to what's immediate. And I think it was kind of ironic, but Jeff's word this morning in relation to some of that. You know, those distractions can take us away from what's important to what's immediate. In the midst of pain, and I'll use I because I'm speaking from personal experience, but it may well be we, in the midst of pain, I very regularly, lose sight of what the end goal can be. And I take my eyes off what I'm supposed to be looking at. And, I mean, Father's Day is a classic example, you know. Most of us here have at one point or another have had our kids come and wake us up. And now, Father's Day is wonderful because, you know, you get to really rejoice in the fact that you've had kids. You can sort of, you know, focus on the fact that they're a blessing and all those sorts of things. Now, obviously, I've got four kids. And the youngest two like to wake you up by jumping on you. Now, with Sharon, that's all right, because she only weighs as much as a sand shoe. But Liam's a little bit different. And so, first thing in the morning, my wife will cook breakfast, and I'll get brekkie in bed, which is a nice thing. And they'll come bounding into the bedroom, up onto the bed, and they will jump on me to wake me up. Now, if they jump on my chest, that's all right. If they hit my legs, that's all right. But if Liam happens to get it wrong and land in a small part that we shall refer to as the lap, I don't actually see that as a blessing. At that point in my life, I am not going, thank God for children. There's a sickness that wells up, starts about there, finishes about there, and I'm trying desperately hard not to throw up. When most of you ladies here, ladies have had kids, you know. When transition hits, you are not thinking about the wonderful blessing that children are going to be. You know, my wife was asking questions why she'd married such an idiot. Who'd ask questions like, are you okay, dear? No, of course I'm not okay. What is it that we expect? I remember even after Peter was born, and the post-labour blessing wasn't what I thought it was either. You know, I looked down at Pete and I said, congratulations, honey, you've given birth to a lizard. And a blue one at that. It wasn't what I expected. It wasn't kind of, you know, the stuff that I'd read in books. And it didn't meet what I thought was going to happen. And both blessing and healing, certainly from my experience, don't always take the form that we expect them to take. In 1991, I had a shoulder operation. And my shoulder used to dislocate, used to pop out backwards. Anybody who's seen the movie Lethal Weapon will know that, you know, Mel Gibson's character, whatever it is, walks over and he pops his shoulder out and away you go. I used to be able to do that, but without any pain. And so I'd pop my, you know, I'd shake hands at a party and pop my shoulder out, and, you know, men would laugh and women would faint, and it was kind of a bit of a practical joke, and away you go. And it got so bad that I would go to bed at night, and the shoulder joint became so weak that I would roll out and it would dislocate in my sleep, which is not really a problem because it doesn't hurt, but it would pinch nerves, and then my whole arm would just go to sleep. And so I'd wake up with this kind of thing, you know, kind of dangling and half out, and away we go. And again, there was no pain in it for me. But I went to the doctors and they said, buddy, once you start to get numbness, it's damaging nerves, we need to repair this. And I was lucky enough, because this was in the days before keyhole surgery, so they opened me up from the tip of my shoulder, sort of almost back into the middle of my back. And I used to go down to Royal North Shore Hospital and a couple of the other hospitals, because it was so unusual to have somebody who could dislocate the shoulder without pain, but it used to pop out backwards. Apparently most shoulders pop out forwards. So they used to wheel me around to all the orthopaedic surgeons and all the orthopaedic interns, and they go, oh, this is what a shoulder looks like, this is how you put it back in. So I would pop my shoulder out and they would put it back in and away we go. So it was of some benefit to somebody at least, you know? Serious, true story. So I'm under all the doctors and they're doing their bits and pieces and they're going, oh, we need to do this and we need to do this and we need to do that. No worries. March comes along and they whack me into hospital and they do the operation. And let me tell you, they call bone surgery wet carpentry. And anybody who's seen RPA will know why. Prior to the operation, I was fine. I thought everything was great. I had no pain. After the operation, I was in so much pain, I couldn't believe it. And burn a shoulder, I couldn't lay on my back. I couldn't lay on my front. I couldn't lay on my side because it would fall either way. And the pain post-operative was just unbelievable. For the next 9 months, I was in rehab 3 days a week at least. All right. It was great fun trying to learn to do all sorts of things left-handed. You know, right hand bang, strap to your body. For those 9 months and for the 3 months after, the 12 months post my operation, I didn't see that operation as a blessing. In fact, I used to ask myself a number of questions because my pain and the stuff that I was going through caused me to look backwards, not look forwards. You know, I'd look back and I'd remember with rose-coloured glasses the fact that, well, at least I could still play tennis. Never mind every time I'd serve, I'd have to put my shoulder back into place. You know, I wasn't in pain, that was okay. But now that I was in pain, somehow it wasn't okay. And the things that I had before, I could live with that. I'd say things like, if I'd known it was going to be like this, I'd never, ever would have done it. Again, remembering the past with rose-coloured glasses. And in the midst of pain, it's sometimes very difficult to see anything clearly. Because our driving goal is to get out of pain, not to sit with it and work through it. Sometimes I wonder if that isn't what healing is about for us in terms of its spiritual context. A need to be actually pain-free rather than walking out obediently or sitting still obediently and waiting for God's call in our life to become evident. Charles Dubois once said, the most important thing in life is to be able at any moment to sacrifice what you are for what you could become. The most important thing in life is to be able at any moment to sacrifice what you are for what you could become. I don't know that there's ever been a more true statement in terms of walking out of a relationship with Christ than that. What could I become? For me, sometimes the chaos of my old life looks much better than the chaos of a new environment. When we look back and we view the past, it actually looks far better than it actually was. I don't know how many times I've said, and I've heard other people say, I'm worse now than I was then. You know, in terms of our emotional pain or where we've come from. If I'd known it was going to be this hard, I never would have done it. We romanticise about how good we had it, when in actual point in fact, the reason that we moved in the first place is because what we moved from was unbearable. I'll never forget when my dad died. We actually were in the hospital ward and we were watching him take his last breaths. And it's no secret that my folks had a pretty strained relationship. And for the last 15 years of their life, they lived at basic separate ends of the house and just fought like Kilkenny cats. Mum was, you know, the sort of person that if she was home alone, she could start an argument, you know. And I'm not kidding you. And I remember as Dad breathed his final breaths, my mum reached out and touched his hand and said, "Oh, it was such a wonderful life, I never would have changed a day of it." And I just was dumbfounded. And I don't mean to speak ill of my parents or the dead or any of that kind of stuff. But I don't know what marriage she was remembering, because it wasn't the same one that I got to view growing up, I tell you. We remember things more romantically than they actually unfolded and they actually were. The old saying that the grass is greener over there. So we move from what we think will be less painful to what we believe will be a more bearable situation. That's the only reason most of us move out of emotional turmoil. I can't stand it here, I'm going to move there because that looks better. Well, that's my experience in my own life. When we arrive and we find that things are not as we expect, and there's more pain or pain of a different kind, we look back and we go, geez, the grass wasn't so bad over there, it looks pretty green over there. And we can spend our time moving backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards between the two rather than actually sitting down and working things through, and we make no progress. A good mate of mine once said to me, and I love this saying, he said, "Don't ever fall for that trap." He said, "The grass is only ever green where you water it." So simple. The grass is only green where you water it. What's he saying? Where you invest your time, where you invest your energy, that's where the pastures will be green and bearable. Now, I don't want people coming up to me saying, you know, are you against healing or any sort of stuff? Absolutely not. The amount of times I wanted to jump up and pray for people is just, you know. I don't want to discourage us from pursuing healing. I merely want us to examine, ask myself the question, what is my motive for seeking it? Am I doing it out of an obedience to what God wants me to do? Or am I doing it because I'm just tired of being in pain? I know for me the pursuit of healing was born out of what I thought were really good and really noble motives. I thought I was doing the right thing. I wanted to get better. I wanted to be better. I didn't want to make the same mistakes. But I actually think that sometimes in the pursuit of that, I did more damage than good. Because if I just sat down long enough to listen to God, I probably would have found out I didn't have to move. And he would have done the work anyway. In those situations, instead of asking questions like, "God, what do you want from me here?" I would ask questions like, "God, what do you want from me here?" Or, "What are you trying to teach me?" I would ask questions like, "What's wrong with me? Why can't I fix this? Why don't I understand this?" And again, the focus is back on me rather than on God. "God, what are you trying to teach me here? What is it you want me to learn here?" And I know most of us know this stuff in our head, so if I'm boring you, I'm really sorry, but for me, it is about being back into basics, because that's where most of the simple stuff and the long-term stuff is learnt and where change really occurs. And those questions for me led to a pattern of cyclic behaviour that just drove me nuts, you know? To the point on several occasions where I have very, very nearly walked away from the church and walked away from my faith. Because I just don't get this, you know? Each week I get up, I go and get prayer, I confess sin, I surrender to God, I feel better for a while, then I get hurt, then I fall into temptation, then I feel guilty, then I go back and I get prayer and I surrender to God. And it's just this never-ending cycle of just madness. where if I'd sat down, been quiet, waited on God, sought first the kingdom of heaven, then everything else might have been added after that. I couldn't understand how, while I desired so much to do the right and the godly thing, I could so consistently fall so short so often. You know, on one hand, I desire to really do the right thing, to practice social justice. But at home, you know, that doesn't happen. I profess on one hand to believe this, but my behaviour demonstrates that. I tell you, it did. It just about sent me insane, you know. And there were times where I thought I was schizophrenic. And there are times I've got to get away from asking those questions. But, you know, I don't know about you, maybe it's only me that has these struggles. You know, what's wrong with me? They're the wrong questions to be asking. Rollo May defined insanity as this: doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting different results. How many of us come to church week in and week out and week in and sit there and go out week in and week out and do the same thing and expect it to be different? Because it's not going to happen. The part of the battle for me in relation to the stuff that I couldn't understand and I couldn't work out, was that there was a whole range of things I didn't know. I certainly subscribe to that old theory of, you know, what you don't know can't hurt you. Now, I reckon there are two really, really big lies I've been told in my life. That is the first one: what you don't know can't hurt you. That is the biggest heap of rubbish. And the second one is, as a kid at school, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Boy, if I ever hear a parent say that, I so badly want to hit them. Because that is just not true. It is not true, you know? The stuff that we say has a lasting impact. You know, flippant comments, all that sort of stuff. What we don't know can drastically and severely influence our life, and because we don't know about it, we can't do anything else. We can't do anything about it. We don't know about it. What can you do about it? I remember one of the first couple of sermons that Jeff preached, you know. I thought he was a good bloke until he mentioned the word algebra. You remember that? One of the first sermons you preached was about algebra. Now, I never got algebra at school, and I don't get it now, you know. The only numbers and letters that were supposed to go together were 24 and VB. They're all right, you know. As for the rest of it, it is completely beyond me. And I've got to say, I'm glad, because it's really been, I haven't missed not knowing about algebra in life. Last night, just to kind of test the theory, I got on the internet last night, because you can find anything on the internet, you know. And I just picked out simple algebra, and I couldn't even get that right, you know. 5a minus 5 equals 7a minus 19. What is the value of a? Now, there were only four answers. Guess how many it took me to get it? Four times. Yeah, beauty. Of course, the value of a is 7. Should have picked that straight away. It was a holy number. I was preparing a sermon. How stupid of me. But you as a teacher could sit there and drop so many hints about algebra, and I just would never get it. I just don't get it. Once I was told the answer, sometimes I could work backwards and go, that makes sense, good. Sometimes even that took a while to sink in. And I often think that sometimes our spiritual lives are like that. That wonderfully English turn of phrase. It seems blindingly obvious to everybody else. But for me, the penny just doesn't drop. And there are things in my spiritual life that are the same. The issues in my life that I'm unaware of, that I don't know about, just seem to be blindingly obvious to everybody else. We don't get it for a number of reasons, I reckon. There are various pressures, outside influences that demand our energy and our time. Our family, we've got kids to look after or things to do. Work, we've got a job to hold down. Church, there's stuff to do, there's stuff to organise. There's pressure from all sides demanding our attention, and they distract us from what's really important, and that is the call in our life. The call in our life to imitate the works of Christ and to pursue holiness, to seek first the kingdom of God. A while back I was in a restaurant, and it was actually a bucks party, small bucks party, five of us. And we're in this restaurant. I was really, really enjoying the conversation. And so I was putting off going to the toilet, you know? And I put it off until my bladder was screaming at me, and decided to then get up. Now, not only as a plumber, I've travelled Australia. I reckon I've been into and seen every slang name you could often ever refer to a toilet as. You know, from the plain simple his and hers to, you know, stallions and mares, or goose and gander, or, you know, Jack and Jill. I've seen them all. But I leave the table, I get up to go to the toilet, and I get to the doors where the toilets are, and I see two signs that I have never seen in my entire life. And I'm a plumber. And it's a reference to fruit. We have mangoes and no mangoes. And now some people have already got it. Mate, I couldn't get it. Again, I just didn't get it. So I'm standing there. My bladder's telling my legs, don't stop. My head's going, what is this all about? And I'm now trying to work out whether I'm in possession of mangoes or not. Are mangoes below the belt? Or are mangoes above the belt? I'm not kidding you. I'm not trying to be rude or crass. You know, I am, and my bladder is going nuts. And I'm standing there, and this bloke was like, what's the guy at a 40? Manuel. Thick Spanish accent. Little waiter comes along, and he can tell, and I'm in severe discomfort by this point. And he goes, sir, I can help you, please. I'm going, yeah, mate, I'm trying to work out if I got mangoes or not. Can you tell me? He goes, oh, no. He says, si, are there mangoes, are there no mangoes? I'm going, yeah, I can read, mate, but which one's which, you know? And he looked at me like I was stupid. I said, no, it's a mangoes, and no mangoes. And I put my arm around him ever so in the most gentle kind of headlock I could muster. And said, listen, mate, I can read. I'm having a big problem with comprehension at the moment, and I'm going to make a mess very soon. He said, no. He said, there are mangoes in here. And no mangoes in here. You see, all of a sudden, the penny dropped. It wasn't a reference to anatomy. It was a play on words. Do you think I could work that out with my bladder going nuts? I think our spiritual lives are like that. We put off and we put off and we put off and we put off what God gently calls us to, until we hit such a point that it's crisis time. And then we jump up and down going, I don't know what to do, help me out. And because there's this outside influence or these outside pressures, of life and church and work and relationship. What we should have done 6 months ago and started a process to holiness that gave us time to work stuff out now becomes a need for immediate action because we ignored all the warning signs earlier. If I'd gone up and gone to the toilet 40 minutes earlier, maybe I might have been able to work that out. Chances are probably not. But the other thing I suppose I want to say about that is that at any point I could have bailed from the situation. Could have, you know, ducked down, ran outside, found a little corner, found a tree, away we go. I'd still be none the wiser to what mangoes and no mangoes are. But even in the midst of the pain, if you sit there, often you will learn something that you never knew or didn't expect. And I think that is realistically what the issue about holiness is all about. Not running, not bailing, but sitting in the midst of it to learn something that's new and unexpected. A couple of weeks ago now, I was in a reasonably good place with God, which was a nice change, I tell you. And I meet pretty regularly with Steve and Marty. We meet most Thursday mornings, and we meet together in an accountability group of three. And I've got to say, I love it. It's going well. There are times where it's incredibly uncomfortable. There are times where we confess and pray and cry and do all that sort of stuff. And we talk about the stuff that's good and the stuff that's not so good. Anyway, I went to bed one night. And the upside of having a group like that is that it's just been really nice to develop that kind of intimacy with those guys, and also to be able to have someone that you can confess stuff to and to share stuff with. That's just awesome. So I'm in a good place with God, and I go to bed. And I have this incredibly vivid dream. Very, very vivid. Remember all the details. A quite explicit dream. And I woke up freaking out. Absolutely freaking out. And it was the sort of dream that would normally just tip me over the edge. To a point where I would begin that cycle again of, you know, falling to temptation, you know, beating up myself, feeling guilty, going to get in prayer, or off we go again. But on this morning, you know, I made the choice to phone Marty and to phone Steve, or to text them. I think it was phone them, may have been both. It's been a lot of help, text and phone both. And I said, this is what's happened. You know, this is normally a trigger for me. You know, I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to go to work. I just want to go back to bed. But I can't. Can you guys just pray for me? This is what's happened. This is what I need. And as a result of that, I reckon I had one of the best days at work I've had in years. The temptations that would normally come my way didn't. I didn't fall into the old behavioural patterns, and I'm being deliberately vague for a good reason, but if anybody wants to know the specifics, come and talk to me later on. But the old temptations didn't present themselves. Or when they did, I just jumped on it straight away. And a strange thing happened. I went home that night, and rather than going home feeling guilty because I'd fallen into temptation, I went home feeling like, this is cool, I can do this. And I started to pray. And instead of, you know, confessing and going, I feel sorry for this guy, I'm just there, God started to reveal certain aspects of the dream and what they meant. And because I wasn't busy feeling guilty and beating up on myself, I was open and able to receive what God had to say about what it all meant. And there was some significant healing that was able to take place in my life as a result of those things. As a result of trying to be holy, of seeking the kingdom of God, of seeking the counsel of the wise, of going, this is what's happening, guys. This is what's happening in my private life. I need some prayer. Please help me out. I want to be like God, to be Christ-like. And as a result of that, revelation and healing came after that. And that's happened on a number of occasions. And just like Steve's going, you know, if you're not in little church, why aren't you? I reckon if you're not in a threesome, a prayer triplet, if you're not in a prayer triplet, why not? Why not? I hate it when they distort language like that. That's never mind. You see, I woke up in the morning and I thought, this is going to be a terrible day. Walked out the path of holiness and unexpected things and unexpected new truths were what happened at the end of the day. My grandpa used to say to me, son, if you look after the pennies, the pounds will look after themselves. You look after the small stuff and the big stuff will take care of itself. We want to get rich, we want to do that stuff, we want to make big money schemes. No, you look after the little things. You look after the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves. The principle is that often what the goal, we think the goal should be, it isn't. And if we focus on what the real issue is, the other stuff will just take care of itself. What do I mean? We asked the students in my class this question. It's part of an examination paper. What is the purpose of a fuse in an electrical circuit? What is the purpose of a fuse in an electrical circuit? It's a multiple choice question. Is it A, to protect the appliances? B, to protect wiring? C, to protect human life? Or my favourite, D, all of the above? Let me give you a hint, it's not D, it's not all of the above. The answer lies in the question. What is the purpose of a fuse? A fuse is designed to protect the wiring. Because the wiring you can't get to. It's behind a wall. So if the fuse blows, all the wire behind the wall is protected. As a result of protecting the wiring, it also protects human life and it also protects the appliance. Our spiritual lives, I think, are a bit similar. We all want to be healed. We want to be obedient. We want to be better husbands. We want to be better wives. We want to be better at everything. I want to put forward today that we will be all those things by default if we become holy and we pursue holiness and not healing. Because I believe that healing will come as a result of being holy. I want to finish today with one last analogy, one last story. Not too many people would have heard the name Jean-François Gravelet, a good French name. He was actually better known as Charles Blondin. And he was a tightrope walker that lived in the mid-1800s. He was actually he visited Sydney on one occasion, but he was very famous for crossing Niagara Falls. And over a four-week period in, I think, about the 1860s, 1870s, he made various trips across from the American side of Niagara Falls to the Canadian side of Niagara Falls. Big tightrope. So, and all the while doing special tricks. You know, he would walk across with a wheelbarrow. On one occasion, he walked across with a table and a chair and a little gas stove, put the table and chair on a rope, balanced on that, cooked an omelette, ate it, and then went across. You can check it out you can check it out on that, not all the stuff too, but there are historical documents that relate to the fact that this bloke actually did what is written about. Just an amazing, amazing talent. But his last feat at Niagara on that particular point of the day was just incredible. The papers had been full of his famous feats, and there were thousands of people on both sides of the falls to witness this guy's last show for this travelling period. And so he gets out and he grabs his wheelbarrow and he grabs his bits and pieces and he goes across and he does a few tricks and he leaves the American side and he heads across to the Canadian side. And once he gets across to the Canadian side, they're all clapping and cheering and carrying on. Anyway, he says, you know, my name is Blonde and I'm the great Blonde. And he said, you know, I have a question for you. And the whole crowd goes silent. I said, do you believe that I can do what I've just done? Walk across there with a man strapped to my back. And they all start going, yeah, we believe. Do you believe? Yeah, we believe. And he works them up. And they start chanting, you know, we believe, we believe, we believe. So he quietens them down. He said, all right, who's coming with me? One bloke put his hand up. One bloke put his hand up. And so he had this special little sling that he'd made that the guy... It went across his neck and down his waist and his feet went through it. And he basically had this tightrope pole and he piggybacked this guy across Niagara Falls. Let me tell you, his name was Harry Colcord. These were the instructions that Blondin gave to Colcord before they left the Canadian side of the bank. You must rest on my back like a dead weight, Blondin told him. If we should sway or stumble, do not attempt to balance yourself. They are not the instructions I would want to hear from a man about to piggyback me on a tightrope. Anybody here who's ever had a pillion passenger on a motorbike will know that you don't want people trying to steer you when you're riding a motorbike. You know, the person on the back is supposed to be just dead weight. On two occasions, he told Colcord to get off because he was tired. So in the middle of Niagara Falls, with this bloke on his back, Colcord gets off his back with his arms draped around Blondin like this, trying to balance. With Blondin going, it's all right, I just need a break, relax. He'd be looking down, man, I tell you what, my butt cheeks would be super glued together. So he climbs back in, and away they go. Finally, they got to the other side. And of course, the crowd went nuts, absolutely nuts, that this bloke had been able to do what he said he would do. On that day, there were thousands of people, who said that they believed. But in actual point of fact, only one person believed. Only one person. Thousands of people had a theory that he could do it. One person believed. Because I believe, for me, I believe a belief motivates you to do something. One man believed. The rest were just spectators. Each week we roll up to church. And we profess that we believe in a God that is real, in a faith that can change, and in a lifestyle that requires participation, much like the thousands on the cliff. They profess that they believed he could do it. We profess that we believe in a faith that is real and a lifestyle that requires participation. But each week, many of us, maybe most of us, I know for me it's true, go home only ever having been spectators. Spectators to God's process of change in our lives. And we engage in what Rollo calls insane behaviour. Doing the same thing over and over again and somehow expecting it to be different. This week, do something different. Do something different. Sacrifice what you are for what you could become. Sacrifice what you are for what you could become. And as a church, as a body, let's pursue holiness and in the process, get healed. Not a bad bonus. Let's just pray. Lord, I want to thank you for the many ways, the different ways that you reveal blessing in our lives. Lord, I pray that we would be awake and in tune with you enough to realise what those moments are when they come along. Lord, help us not to balk at the pain, to not take our eyes off the end of the street, to not look at the buildings, to not look at the things that we're frightened of, but help us to focus on the kingdom, Lord. Help us to focus on you. That's what we profess. Help us to focus on you, Lord. Quieten us down in the moments of turbulence, Lord. And help us just to rest and relax in you. Amen. I